Our next case is number 01-1772, United States against Olson, et al. Ms. Hernandez-Ott-Malaby.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm here today representing Andrew Acosta, but the arguments I'll be presenting are on behalf of all the defendants concerning the two RICO issues raised in the joint briefs to this Court. The first concerns the government's failure to prove a single continuous enterprise throughout the 12 years alleged in the indictment. As is set forth in our brief, the government alleged in the superseding indictment and was charged to the jury the Milwaukee chapter of the Almighty Latin King Nation. As the proof showed, though, there was a gap of a couple of months in 1995 when the organization ceased to exist. This requires reversal.
Are you arguing that the Latin Kings disappeared as an ongoing enterprise in Milwaukee?
The Milwaukee chapter of the Almighty Latin King Nation, the organization that the government vaunted as its hallmark, did disappear in Milwaukee for a 1 to 2 month period at the end of 1995.
In other words, it wasn't a simply less well or organized organization.
No.
You're saying that all any semblance of it was gone.
Yes.
Just gone.
Yes. What happened here, Your Honor, is at trial, the government, over days and days of testimony, described a very structured organization. That was the basis of their proof of this enterprise. That's what they used to distinguish it from a simple conspiracy. The fact that there was an Inca, the fact that there was Kasinka, an enforcer, a treasurer, that meetings were held on a regular basis, that dues were collected. But at this period of time, all of that activity stopped. No one was following a leader. There were no meetings. There were no dues being collected. There were random shootings amongst the Latin Kings themselves. There was infighting. All of these were against the rules that the government vaunted as being the hallmarks of this particular enterprise. So yes, to the extent that this government's burden here was to prove an enterprise, and that the proof that they gave of this enterprise was this structure, and that this structure did in fact go away for a period of time in 1995, does render it insufficient as to this enterprise charge, this 12-year Milwaukee chapter of the Almighty Latin King Nation. And when you look at the proof here, what happened here is that the first witness, Ray Rivera, who was on the stand for 3 days, who actually came in to start the organization again, confirmed the gap. Thomas Overland, who was a defendant in this trial for 3 weeks, who understood the government's theory, who heard it for 3 weeks, also confirmed the gap. The only witnesses that didn't was a witness who was completely incorrect in time. He said that the day that a person named Emmanuel Vega was violated out of the Latin Kings, Menial, the Inca. After that period of time, a number of witnesses testified that chaos occurred. One of these witnesses said, well, he was violated out at the same date that the next person was brought in.
Counsel, an organization in chaos because of a leadership gap of a couple of months is not an organization that has disappeared.
But in this case, it was. It wasn't just an organization in chaos, say, when a CEO of an organization leaves, and there's a gap where the vice president takes over, another analogous kind of situation.
Maybe you want to pick a different analogy.
Sure. I agree. Corporate analogies are not appropriate in this situation. This is an associated, in fact, enterprise. But here, really, the Latin Kings, and you see it in the government's case, it's all organized around this notion of a manifesto and this notion of rules, this notion that there was something other than just the crimes. If it was just the crimes, it wouldn't be RICO. So here, what was happening during this period of time were just the crimes. All the other hallmarks of the enterprise disappeared, and that is not sufficient under RICO. This circuit has ruled in a number of decisions that the difference between conspiracy and RICO sometimes is very small, but it is the notion of some type of organization other than just the commission of crimes. And what these witnesses were testifying to is there was just crimes going on. There weren't the other hallmarks of the enterprise going on. So I agree, Judge Sykes, it's not, you're right, it's not the proper analogy to analogize this to a corporation, but it was a situation really where it was just random crimes happening at this point. There wasn't the organization moving it forward. It wasn't connected to the organization. There were people shooting each other and doing terribly violent acts to one another.
Well, there wasn't anything happening. Who was doing the violating in at this time?
There wasn't any evidence of violating in happening during the break.
By the way, what's the difference between violating in and violating out? In other words, the same physical acts?
Slightly different. And I apologize, this is very violent, but with respect to the violating in, the members would walk down a row of Latin Kings and they would be punched and kicked violently. One of the witnesses testified that he was hospitalized afterwards with broken ribs. It was a rite of manhood that they went through. Violating out was even more violent.
Right.
Sometimes
violating
resulting
out
in death.
I understand.
Yes. So they were both acts with violence, and this was a violent organization that they were describing here. And here, during this time, there was also violence going on, but it wasn't the same connection with the enterprise. And that's why this case is really analogous to the United States versus Morales case in the Second Circuit. Granted, as the government points out, there was a much larger gap, a 7-year gap, and all of the...
And they're all in prison.
And they're all incarcerated.
And they... It disappeared.
And in that case, what was interesting, though, is that the government tried to prove that the enterprise continued. These folks had friends in common, there were shared phone numbers, and when they all emerged from prison, the exact same enterprise emerged, and they immediately commenced offense with crimes. The Second Circuit said that's not enough. Here, the enterprise before and the enterprise afterwards were actually slightly different. The government emphasizes in its brief how Ray Rivera wanted to make this like the mafia, and in fact was a very structured enterprise after the break. Before, it was not as structured. But the gap was nonetheless there. And it granted, the 300 members of the Latin Kings were not incarcerated during that period of time.
What relief is Acosta seeking on his sentencing claim? I assume he wants his sentence vacated and remanded rather than a limited Palladino remand.
Yes.
Am I correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
And the reason being, Your Honor, is that the court in this case was constrained to give him a life sentence. There was never any opportunity for him to do anything but that. So in this case, because he preserved his rights to appeal, he should have the opportunity for a full remand in this matter because the court had nothing but the option but to give him life in prison. And also, with respect to that, just very briefly on Racketeering Act 8, it is Acosta's and Mr. Martinez's contention that that act was not sufficiently linked with the enterprise, sufficiently related to the enterprise, so as to be part of that consideration. Granted, if the only thing that this court does is reverse on Racketeering Act 8, the RICO count still stands, but we contend that if it was reversed as to that Racketeering Act, it would most materially affect his sentence. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Castle. We'll hear now from Ms. Keppel.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. My name is Kelly Keppel, and I represent the appellant Wilfredo Vasquez. Your Honors, in this short amount of time, I would like to focus my discussion on why this case is different from a typical case of multi-defendants being tried together, and why the lower court abused its discretion by not granting severance to Mr. Vasquez. Your Honors, trying Thomas Overland and my client together in the same proceeding resulted in numerous prejudices, and the totality of those prejudices rose to the level of denying a fair trial to my client.
Assume for a moment that the court had ordered Vasquez's trial separated. What would stop the government from calling Overland in the separate trial?
Your Honor, in that case, certainly they could call him in the severed trial, but the question in terms of having them tried together was not simply the testimony that he elicited. It was the numerous prejudices that resulted in having those two individuals tried together. For example, their defenses were opposed to one another. So, in effect, the attorney for Thomas Overland was attacking my client's defense throughout the trial, And in such, he was acting as a second prosecutor.
How is that different from United States versus Suffrent?
In the case of Suffrent,
no severance was required when one defendant argued that she participated in a conspiracy because she was dominated by a co-defendant, and the co-defendant claimed there was no conspiracy.
Right. The difference in that case is in the evidence that was presented. In that case, the evidence that she was coerced wasn't her making the case that her co-defendant actually did commit these crimes and she was coerced by it. The evidence was presented by an expert who said things like, this woman is highly susceptible to pressure from people. The evidence was different. In this case, Thomas Overland's attorney was actually undercutting my client's defense for the full amount of time that he was in the trial. So the facts in the case are different, and the evidence in that case of coercion didn't come out in a manner that it was directly undercutting the defense of the other defendant. Your Honor, in this case, if you add to the question of the antagonistic defenses and the fact that Thomas Overland's attorney was acting as a second prosecutor, and the defense that Thomas Overland was mounting in addition to attacking my client's defense also went and spoke directly to the case that the government was trying to make. My client was arguing that there was no organization. Thomas Overland was arguing that, in fact, there was an organization and that his client, based on a fear of that organization, was coerced into committing crimes for a period of several years. Judge Adelman himself, in terms of another prejudice, completely misunderstood and misconstrued this defense. He thought that Thomas Overland was arguing that he was coerced by a single individual as opposed to the entire organization. Your Honor, I know that the abuse of discretion standard is very high to meet, but Judge Adelman couldn't possibly have properly exercised his discretion in this case, given the fact that he was basing all of his decisions on severance on a theory of a defense that wasn't actually the true defense that Thomas Overland was mounting. The prejudice was again enhanced by the fact that in mid-trial, Thomas Overland then was allowed to plead guilty and testify against the remaining defendants. Now, we do understand that the government does have to be able to try defendants together, and in the vast majority of the case, the type of prejudice that results from having joint defendants doesn't rise to the level of questioning the integrity of the proceedings. And while severance isn't favored, however, it is one of the constitutional safeguards in place to ensure that the state doesn't take away one's liberty without providing a fair trial first. The multiplicity of prejudices that arose in this case by having Overland be part of the trial did rise to that level in this case, and we ask that you correct that error today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from Mr. Sostrom.
May it please the court, in addition to the joint RICO issues that have already been discussed, Mr. Martinez raises two issues that are unique to his appeal. The first is under Palladino that at this point both parties agree that a limited remand would be appropriate here. And then the second concerns the April 30th, 1998 statements that Martinez made regarding the Morales murder to Assistant U.S. Attorneys Marino, Taxman, and Larson. Now, these statements should have been excluded for two reasons. First, they were made in the course of plea discussions under Federal Rule of Evidence 410. Based on the totality of the circumstances surrounding that April 30th, 1998 meeting, Martinez subjectively and reasonably believed that he was discussing plea negotiations. Now, Martinez, at the pretrial hearings, asserted that before the meeting, FBI Special Agent Kraft made certain statements concerning a potential 10-year deal for Martinez if he cooperated, and brought up the case of Sammy the Bull Gravano, who received lenient treatment in exchange for his cooperation. While in custody on another charge, Martinez was taken to the U.S. Attorney's offices by Special Agent Kraft. There, he met with Assistant U.S. Attorneys Larson and Marino Taxman. Now, at the pretrial hearing, Kraft's and Larson's own testimony confirmed that the purpose of this meeting was to explore Martinez's potential cooperation and see if he might offer to incriminate others in exchange for a promise or a deal. Now, at the meeting, the parties discussed Martinez's involvement in the Morales homicide, And at the end, when it was confirmed that everything was on the record, Martinez ended the meeting. Based on these facts, Martinez subjectively and reasonably believed that he was engaged in plea negotiations, and the statement should have been suppressed.
He was Mirandized at the beginning of this meeting, wasn't he?
He was. But again, the test here is the totality of the circumstances. And in this case, the fact that he was Mirandized isn't dispositive when you look at the other facts of what Special Agent Kraft told him before the meeting, what the purpose of the meeting was, according to Kraft and Larson's own testimony, and the fact that at the end of the meeting, when it was confirmed to him that everything was on the record, he ended the meeting. Now, apart from the plea negotiations, the statements also should have been suppressed because the prosecutors violated their ethical obligations under Wisconsin Supreme Court Rule 3.8b. Now, the district court correctly found that a violation did in fact occur here, but the district court abused its discretion in not suppressing the statements nonetheless. The nature of the prosecutor's duty is set forth in the plain language of Rule 3.8b, which requires prosecutors to explain the procedure for and provide reasonable opportunity for a defendant to obtain counsel. These are obligations beyond those set forth in Miranda. Now, although courts did not directly address whether Rule 3.8b applied before the initiation of adversary proceedings, prior authority on Disciplinary Rule 7104 did in fact hold that ethical obligations apply before the initiation of adversary proceedings. Similar to Rule 3.8, which applies to the accused in a criminal case, Disciplinary Rule 7104 prohibits communications with any party in a matter that is represented by counsel. Now, for example, in Hamad, the Second Circuit rejected the argument that this rule only applied after adversary proceedings commenced, noting that the timing of proceedings is within the prosecutor's unique discretion, and that if the rule were based on that, it would be too simple to simply manipulate the timing of charges. Based on the failure to comply with the plain language of Rule 3.8b, where the government should have known that these obligations applied at the time of the April 30, 1998 meeting before formal charges had commenced, the district court abused its discretion in failing to suppress these statements. So because the district court erred in, one, not suppressing the statements because they occurred during plea discussions, and, two, because the prosecutors violated their ethical obligations in the meeting, the statement should have been suppressed, and Martinez asked the court to reverse his conviction with respect to Racketeering Act 8 and the murder of Angelique Morales. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from Mr. Wirtz.
May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Wirtz, and I represent the defendant, Larry Olson. For the last 7 years, Larry Olson has been serving a prison term that his trial court did not want to assign to him and that overestimates both the level of his criminal culpability and the depth of his involvement as a member of the Latin Kings organization. Mr. Olson asked this court to recognize these facts and avoid the delay that would be entailed in a limited remand and instead award him a full remand, allowing Judge Adelman to reevaluate the evidence and resentence him accordingly with that evidence.
What do we do, for instance, about the Harmelin case, where a sentence of life for a smaller amount of cocaine than we have here was found not to meet the standard for cruel and unusual punishment?
I believe what distinguishes Mr. Olson's case is the fact that although the guidelines have been changed again since Mr. Olson's initial brief was filed, there's no branch of the government right now that appears to believe that he is serving a sentence that reflects his criminal culpability. Judge Adelman, I believe, at Mr. Olson's sentencing, made it clear that he saw Mr. Olson as a minimal participant or a minor participant in the Latin Kings organization. The Sentencing Commission, after Mr. Olson was sentenced, decided to amend the guidelines, applying a mitigating role cap that would make a sentence like Mr. Olson's of 262 months not applicable anymore, because individuals like Mr. Olson, who are minor players in their drug conspiracies, don't deserve to have a sentence as long as they have gotten for many years. So the Sentencing Commission changed the guidelines. Congress enforced and accepted the Sentencing Commission's recommendations. So essentially, no one appears to believe that he is serving a sentence that represents what he did as a member of the Latin Kings. And in Palladino, this court recognized that it's a miscarriage of justice for a defendant to be told by a reviewing court that although his sentencing judge didn't believe that he deserved the sentence that he received, that that's a miscarriage of justice. And I think it's equally a miscarriage of justice in this instance to allow Mr. Olson to spend so much time in prison when it really appears that no one believes he deserves to be there. I think it's important to note that Larry Olson is different from the other Latin Kings that are here before you today. This fact becomes clear when you look at the testimony or the statements made by Judge Adelman at Mr. Olson's sentencing, where Judge Adelman referred to him as a minor participant in the Latin Kings organization who held no rank and had no authority and simply did what Wilfredo Vasquez essentially told him to do. The difference between he and the other Latin Kings is also evidenced by the fact that during an 8-week trial where stories came out and testimony was provided about murders and attempted murders, kidnapping, assaults, that Larry Olson was not accused of nor convicted of taking part in any violent acts of any kind. And finally, the difference between Mr. Olson's sentence and the other Latin Kings that are before you today also highlights how he is different. His sentence is 262 months, and although that exaggerates the depth of his involvement with the Latin Kings, it's significantly different than life in prison, which all the other defendants face. Mr. Olson deserves to be resentenced in part because Judge Adelman made it clear during his sentencing hearing that he would like to sentence him, would have liked to have sentenced him below what was the mandatory guideline range at the time, but also because the evidence that formed the basis of Mr. Olson's sentence, the government now concedes, is full of holes. There are errors in the paragraphs of Mr. Olson's pre-sentence report that Judge Adelman specifically focused on when he created Mr. Olson's sentence, and those errors are significant. And it's simply wrong for Mr. Olson to be exposed to such a lengthy prison term based on unreliable information. He has a right, a due process right, to be sentenced on reliable information. The government concedes that the evidence used or the information used by Judge Adelman was not accurate. And I think and Mr. Olson asks you to recognize these facts and remand his case to the trial court. It's important to recognize the fact that in Mr. Olson's reply brief, there's an error because on the day that his brief was finalized, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals changed the way that it views plain error analysis, and they've accepted now a procedure that is similar to what this court has accepted, and that's different from what it was the day before his brief was finalized, and that's unfortunate, but I want to recognize that fact. But there is disagreement among the circuits still, and what the circuits appear to agree on is that if a defendant can show his reviewing court that his trial court judge would like to have been able to sentence him below what was the mandatory guideline range at the time, he deserves to have his sentence vacated and his case remanded to the trial court. Judge Adelman was not happy with the sentence that he had to give Mr. Olson. He referred to him as a minor participant with no power, with no rank within the organization, and someone who simply did what he was told to do. But he looked at Mr. Olson and he said, despite this fact, there's something called the Federal Sentencing Guidelines, and they have a significant restricting effect on what judges are able to do. And here we are, essentially telling Larry Olson that his hands were tied. So he sentenced him to 262 months. The evidence that Judge Adelman used to fashion that sentence, there's problems with that evidence. He specifically refers to 7 paragraphs of Mr. Olson's pre-sentence report in fashioning Mr. Olson's sentence. Those 7 paragraphs essentially summarize the testimony provided by 7 Latin Kings witnesses who testified at trial. The government now concedes that key portions of that testimony, the testimony provided by four of those seven witnesses, contained errors. For example, Miguel Romero did not testify that Larry Olson was somehow selling 1 to 2 ounces of crack cocaine out of the Olson house that was owned by Mr. Olson's grandmother. He did not, that his PSR stated that he, that Mr. Romero testified that he was producing that much of cocaine, but in fact, this was not correct. This was a mischaracterization of that testimony. The government says that Mr. Romero would have testified to that fact, but it was up to the government to bring that evidence out. The government has the burden of showing what Mr. Olson's sentence should be based on, and they made a mistake in not asking them that question if that was what they wanted to do. In addition, thinking that he would have testified that way, it's impossible to say, because all of the witnesses who were testifying to the amount of drugs that Mr. Olson was supposedly involved with had severe, definite inconsistencies in their testimony. Doug Bayrice did not testify that Mr. Olson was selling crack cocaine out of the Olson house. Mr. Olson's PSR said that he did. That's another significant error. Thomas Overland did not testify that he was delivering cocaine to the Olson house. He was delivering cocaine to another house. The government says it's harmless to have that error in the PSR, but Judge Adelman specifically referred to these paragraphs of Mr. Olson's PSR when he fashioned his sentence. It defies logic to say that it's harmless when these are specifically the pieces of evidence that Judge Adelman relied on. The government points out that Brian Turner testified that Mr. Olson was selling approximately an ounce of cocaine a week out of the Olson house. And it's conceivable that Judge Adelman may have relied to some extent on Mr. Turner's testimony, but it's impossible to say because Judge Adelman didn't refer to Mr. Turner at all at Mr. Olson's sentencing. He referred to the 7 paragraphs that are full of errors. Mr. Turner, in addition, was a very inconsistent witness who told police and FBI agents prior to the Latin Kings trial that Larry Olson was only selling marijuana out of the Olson house. So it's impossible to say exactly what testimony Judge Adelman was using, was relying on when he fashioned Mr. Olson's sentence beyond accepting that he was basing it on these 7 paragraphs of his PSR. Because there are holes in that evidence, Mr. Olson asked this court to recognize those holes and the unfairness that he would experience if this sentence is allowed to stand. So for those reasons, based on the statements that Judge Adelman made when he sentenced Mr. Olson and the fact that Mr. Olson's sentence is based on evidence that the government concedes is incorrect and full of holes, Mr. Olson asks you to avoid further delay, vacate his sentence, and immediately send his case back to Judge Adelman so he can give him the kind of sentence that he would have liked to have done in the first instance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wirtz. We'll hear now from Mr. Foley.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Rick Froling. I'm an AUSA from Milwaukee, and along with Green Marino Taxman, I represent the United States in this appeal. During my time, I'd like to address 3 of the categories of issues. First, why a rational juror could find the existence of a single enterprise. Second, Mr. Vasquez's arguments and explain why the trial court had it right and why no new trial is required. And finally, address the sentencing issues. Ms. Taxman will address the remaining issues. Just briefly on the enterprise, there is a disagreement between the parties as to whether this is a variance or an amendment-type claim. However, what the parties agree on is that if any rational juror could have found the existence of a single enterprise, the inquiry is at an end. And in this case, a rational juror could find there was no break. The Latin Kings did not disappear during this brief power struggle in late 1995 into early 1996. Now, what the evidence showed was that in approximately December of 1995, it's true, Mr. Vega was out as Inca. The Latin Kings held a trial, kicked him out, and then in approximately early January 6, 1996, Mr. Rivera comes in. The fact that Mr. Rivera wanted things more organized doesn't mean that the Latin Kings had ceased to exist or disappeared. And in fact, there's testimony from various witnesses, including Alejandro Vallejo, Brian Turner, David Karras, and Mark Turner, that in fact there was no break. Specifically, although it wasn't an effectual leader, Mr. Karras, Mark Turner, and Alejandro Vallejo described C.K., who had been the Kasinka, as the acting Inca or someone who was trying to hold things together. Quite simply, both before and after the alleged break, there were a Corona and Hefe overseeing the Milwaukee set. The Milwaukee set, the Cagal Kings, were at war with rival gangs. They maintained guns, nation guns, and held security, paid dues, followed the manifesto, enforced the rules, and had Mr. Vasquez and the Junior Kings completing missions. That said, even if there had been a break, the government submits that this is a variance claim, not an amendment, and the defendants would have to show prejudice, which they cannot do. Turning to the arguments made by Mr. Vasquez this morning, specifically the antagonistic defenses, there was no need for a severance here. The district court did not abuse its discretion. The argument made by Mr. Vasquez's counsel this morning is essentially that in order to accept Mr. Overland's defense, you would have to convict Mr. Vasquez, and that Judge Adelman just misunderstood what was being argued. The transcript cites specifically pages 1676 through 79, as well as a segment from 3607 through 3615, make clear that Judge Adelman didn't misunderstand what was going on. He, in each instance, when those excerpts pointed out in the reply brief occurred, where Mr. Overland's counsel said, it's an organizational thing as well. The judge stated he understood. He just concluded that regardless of whether the Latin Kings, regardless of what type of group it was, coerced Mr. Overland, a rational jury, a jury could find that both should be acquitted because the Latin Kings were not a continuing racketeering enterprise. In addition, Judge Rovner, in response to your question to Mr. Vasquez's counsel, there is no evidence that wouldn't have come in had Mr. Vasquez been tried separately. The same evidence of Mr. Vasquez ordering murders, assigning security, leading manifesto classes, ordering junior kings to sell drugs for the nation, maintaining nation guns, the dues and attendance, that all would have come in. So there is no prejudice in this case. Would also note that the trial court did give proper jury instructions and to give separate consideration. Speaking of jury instructions, that takes us to the issue of whether the district court abused its discretion in allowing Mr. Overland to testify. In his reply brief, Mr. Vasquez essentially argues that the limiting instructions weren't enough because they were generic. They weren't enough because Mr. Overland had implicated Mr. Vasquez before pleading guilty, and Mr. Overland had been able to tailor his testimony because he had seen the first 3 weeks of trial. On the instruction point, it's actually not true that the instructions were generic. There was a generic instruction at the end of the case, a limiting instruction. But directly before Mr. Overland testified, Judge Adelman instructed the jury that while we're waiting for the next witness, I want to make an instruction concerning the next witness. The next witness is Thomas Overland, who you'll recall was a former defendant in this case. Mr. Overland pled guilty to count one of the indictment and is now going to be testifying on behalf of the United States. I want to instruct you that you're not to draw any negative inference against the remaining defendants whatsoever based upon Mr. Overland's decision to enter a guilty plea and to testify during trial.